Welcome to Boston Globe Live. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. In the next hour, we'll be bringing you news from the Thursday, June 18th edition of the Boston Globe. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Mass Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Harry reading with Anthony, live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And before I begin with news from the nation and world, our volunteer meteorologist Bill Ruggiero wanted me to announce that we are actually under a tornado watch until 7 p.m. tonight in the greater Worcester area. So thank you very much for that, Bill. And now let's get into the news. Our first story. Trump chose to go to war, but Vance gets the fallout. VP's political future hangs in the balance. This story is by James Pindell. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lobbied to go to war with Iran for months. President Trump eventually agreed, but it's Vice President J.D. Vance who is left holding the bag. Ever since the White House announced a deal on Sunday, it's Vance who has been on a nonstop media tour to try to sell it as a good thing. He has been the face of a so far unreleased deal, but from the way Vance talks about it, it doesn't accomplish any of the central goals of the war in the first place. The Iranian regime is still in place. Nothing has changed with Iran's nuclear program. While the country's missile program is depleted, it's still kicking. Iran's proxy terrorist groups in Lebanon, Gaza, and Yemen are still there. Our next story, wildfire forces evacuation in Washington State. This is by Martha Bellew. High winds drove a wildfire into an eastern Washington neighborhood, forcing the evacuation of about 1,500 people and destroying at least 15 homes, officials said Wednesday. One person was reported missing by a family member, but officials were unable to go into the fire zone to search for them because the conditions remained dangerous Wednesday afternoon. Spokane County Sheriff John Knowles said in a press conference, "They have a location to look, but it's not safe to look there at the moment." Many people living in the densely populated neighborhoods had to flee on a moment's notice, sometimes after an officer knocked on their door, leaving behind belongings and in some cases critical medications, Knowles said. People were being escorted Wednesday by an officer to their homes one by one to access those essential needs. But they were then taken back out, Noel said. The evacuation order remained in effect Wednesday. And again, that was an eastern area of the state of Washington. And our next story, Trump angrily defends deal to end war on Iran. Critics have said the agreement achieves less than the one President Barack Obama negotiated and signed in 2015. This story is by Erica Green. President Trump on Wednesday issued a fiery defense of his deal with Iran, lashing out at critics who have said the agreement achieves even less than the one President Barack Obama negotiated, and threatening to bomb Iran again if it doesn't adhere to the agreement. Appearing at the Group of Seven summit global leaders in Evian, Lesbans, France, Trump denied that the U.S. was, in effect, paying Iran to agree to the recently negotiated peace deal. And in an expletive-laden rant, he proclaimed that his deal was better than the one Obama signed with Iran in 2015. A spokesperson for Obama said he would not be commenting Wednesday, but referred to his remarks from an interview with ABC's Good Morning America over the weekend. In it, he said he doubted that the New Deal would be significantly different or a significant improvement from the one his administration negotiated. He said that it was a reminder that the U.S. cannot just bully our way or bomb our way to solutions. Our next story. Scientists express some optimism for world's coral reefs. Scientists have used artificial intelligence to detect sheltered pockets in parts of the world where corals are more likely to survive. This story is by Catherine Horelt. In Nairobi, as spiking ocean temperatures are devastating reefs around the world, a handful of scientists have found a reason for cautious optimism. They've used artificial intelligence, or AI, to detect sheltered pockets where cool currents, reduced exposure to sunlight, and locations outside cyclone paths mean corals are more likely to survive. The study, led by the Wildlife Conservation Society and presented on Tuesday at the Our Ocean Conference in Mombasa, Kenya, is undergoing peer review for publication in the journal Environmental Research Letters. Five scientists identified 42 factors that create the conditions for the coral havens, called refugia, and then ran those through a program with nearly 38,000 human observations of coral cover and composition gathered over 65 years. The program identified more than 5,800 square miles of climate-resilient ocean in 72 countries. The work found three times as many refugia as a landmark 2018 assessment known as the 50 Reefs Study, the first paper to systematically identify areas around the globe where coral might still be saved. Scientists and environmentalists said the new assessment offered a more nuanced picture of the state of the world's reefs and could help fine-tune conservation priorities. And in other stories from the Associated Press, migrants clash with police at a deportation site in South Africa. Police fired rubber bullets and used stun grenades against migrants protesting Wednesday near a community hall in South Africa, where thousands are being processed for deportation by authorities. The clashes came as tensions over immigration surge in Africa's richest country following a series of anti-migrant marches and reports of attacks on foreign nationals. The migrants who gathered near the hall in the eastern city of Durban are mainly Malawians who initially turned up there more than a week ago to be voluntarily repatriated to their home country on buses provided by their government, authorities said. The premier of KwaZulu-Natal province, where Durban is, has said nearly 10,000 Malawians have been camping in a park near the hall waiting to go home. But delays in that process have led South African authorities to establish an immigration court at the hall and implement formal deportation processes, according to the Ministry of Home Affairs. Video broadcast by South African television stations showed groups of protesters throwing rocks and sticks at police in the streets near the hall, and police officers responding with stun grenades and rubber bullets. In another story from the Associated Press, Finland lifts nuclear device ban. Story by Amelia Nuremberg and Johanna Lamola. Finnish lawmakers voted Wednesday to overturn a Cold War-era total ban on nuclear devices, which the Finnish government says will strengthen the NATO alliance and offer the country better security. Nuclear weapons are a contentious issue in Finland, but now, in exceptional cases, Finland will allow nuclear explosives to be imported into, transported through, or held in the country. Finland joined NATO in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and has been warily eyeing its neighbor as Russian forces beef up bases and build military infrastructure near their 830-mile border. Top Finnish officials argue that overturning the ban would allow Finland to take further advantage of NATO's protection and better suit the needs of the Mutual Defense Alliance. This historic reform strengthens the security of Finland and of NATO as a whole, Antti Häkkinen, the Finnish defense minister, said. By dismantling the Cold War-era total ban on nuclear explosives, we are aligning our legislation with that of our closest NATO allies, he said in a separate post before the vote. World Hunger to Worsen, UN Warns, by Giada Zampano. Rome. The United Nations Food Agencies warned Wednesday that acute hunger is set to worsen across 13 global hotspots in the coming months, with conflict, funding shortages, and climate shocks pushing millions closer to famine. The Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program said in a new joint report, conditions are expected to deteriorate between June and November 2026, with around 266 million people already facing high levels of acute food insecurity, and called for urgent action. Sudan, South Sudan, Yemen, and Palestine remain the countries of greatest concern, the report said. While Nigeria and Somalia have been added to that category as conditions worsen and famine risk rise. Our next story, Tropical Storm Arthur brings flash floods to Gulf Coast. Tropical Storm Arthur is the first of the Atlantic season and threatens the southern U.S. with dangerous flash flooding. By David Fisher. A disorganized cluster of storms that has been plaguing the Gulf Coast for days came together to form Tropical Storm Arthur on Wednesday, the first tropical cyclone of the season in the Atlantic Basin. Flash flooding was the main threat from Arthur, a weak tropical storm that the National Hurricane Center in Miami said would be short-lived. Maximum sustained winds were around 45 miles per hour, with little change in strength forecasts before it is expected to dissipate by Wednesday night or early Thursday. A tropical storm warning remained in effect for a roughly 350-mile stretch along the coast of Texas and Louisiana. The storm hung over coastal Texas on the same day a World Cup match was being played between Portugal and the Democratic Republic of Congo in Houston. The stadium is covered and no plans were announced to move or reschedule the match. National Hurricane Center Director Michael Brennan said during a briefing that flash flood warnings were already being issued in the Houston metro area, with more likely to follow across the region, even after the center of the storm passes. All right, we're going to take a public service announcement break and then have some music, and then we'll turn it over to Anthony to read the stories from the front page. Stay tuned.
Would you like to hear news from Auburn, Grafton, Millbury, and Sutton that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 5 p.m.
Glad Tidings, Scots Bring Party to Boston, by Brian Macquarie. Since they swaggered into town last week for the World Cup, they seem to be everywhere, kilt-clad throngs singing, chanting, and marching to the skirl of bagpipes. They even raised the roof at Fenway Park, no easy feat these days. They are the very thirsty soldiers of Scotland's tartan army, as the national team's fans are known, here to cheer on their beloved players, and they are just the release valve that Boston needed to shake off any lingering doubts that the region could pull it off. They've become the area's honorary mascots for the World Cup, and they've brought more visitors to Boston for a single event than any country ever has, says Dave O'Donnell, vice president of Meet Boston, which promotes the city. We knew that we had struck gold when we learned back in December that the Tartan Army would be coming here, but I don't think that anyone could have predicted the actual impact, which has been immense and electrifying, O'Donnell said. As many as 50,000 Scots have descended upon Boston, tourism officials said, and the city has embraced them. The Scots won their first game Saturday, and then 6,000 of their raucous fans turned the Red Sox game Sunday night into a rollicking echo chamber of Scottish soccer chants. Red Sox officials said they might never replicate what they saw and heard at Fenway, where a blocks-long river of Scots, many of whom don't know baseball from rounders, were led by bagpipers wearing sunglasses and sneakers. It was almost indescribable. It was unlike anything we've ever hosted, said Travis Polio, director of Red Sox ticket strategy. Many Scots had heard of ball game held on Scottish Heritage Night through word-of-mouth connections that went viral. And now that Scotland, which defeated Haiti on Saturday, has notched its first World Cup victory in 36 years, the party will continue through at least Friday night when it will face Morocco at Foxborough. As one of the popular chants proclaims, "No Scotland, no party." To reinforce that playful ethos, the traveling Scots are transplanting a decades-old practice from home and placing traffic cones atop statues, George Washington, Bill Russell, and Mayor Kevin White's heads among them. The attitude is, "We might not get another one of these, so we are going to enjoy every single second of this one," said Dave McCarthy, a retired sports writer for the Scottish Daily Record, who has been following the entertainment from his homeland. For the Scots, the World Cup is a chance to revel abroad in the unique identity of a country that hasn't been independent for three centuries. Its fiercely held identity also reflected in the country's unofficial anthem, Flower of Scotland, which recalls a victory over England more than 700 years ago by King Robert the Bruce at the Battle of Bannockburn. When Scottish fans sang that song before Saturday's game, they are believed to have set a World Cup decibel record. "For us, qualification for major tournaments just getting there is to be celebrated," McCarthy said. "And when it comes to excitement, exuberance, friendliness, and fandom, there is no holding back." On Saturday afternoon, hours before Scotland faced off against Haiti, the insides of sweltering pubs near Government Center were packed with chanting, lager-downing Scots. Mention that your last name begins with Mac and you'll be studied and you studied in Edinburgh and Aberdeen, as I did, and feel free to join the party, not that anyone seems excluded. At the Bell in Hand, taps for draft beer already had run dry, and at nearby Hennessy's, blue-shirted fans stood shoulder to shoulder and front to back, all while sinning and sweating in very un-Scotland-like heat and humidity. The Dubliner, a restaurant and bar opposite City Hall Plaza, has gone through 150 kegs of Tennent's, a popular Scottish beer. The Haven in Jamaica Plain, the city's only Scottish restaurant, has emptied 75. The Scots have brought an awesome depth of spirit and sense of fun. The soccer match is number one to them, and the party atmosphere a very close number two, said Terry Nixon, a longtime bartender at Mr. Dooley's in the Fitch Financial District. Irish pubs such as Mr. Dooley's have turned into roaring Scottish enclaves, where the thick Glasgow accents can make well-intentioned New Englanders wonder if they're speaking the same language. If a translator isn't handy, Bostonians can simply smile and say, "Lang may your lum reek," a wish for good health that means long may your chimney smoke. Or try, "Och I de nu," an inside Scottish joke about the country's bewildering dialects. The sinning, caroling, and good-natured imbibing are no surprise to local musician Jerry Bell, an Edinburgh native whose Massachusetts-born son, Callum, has been hired to play the bagpipes at the Fan Zone at Gillette Stadium. "We are all great singers and loud singers, and we are used to singing in the streets," Bell said. "We are also proud of the Scottish flag, and most of all, we can all wear the national dress while celebrating in Boston." "Girls find the furry pouch hilarious," Bell added, referring to the sporran worn in front of the kilt. "It becomes the ultimate chat-up line that one can discuss with the ladies till the wee hours." Christy Milner said the Scots she met at Emmett's, a pub near the Government Center, set a high and unexpected bar for American patrons. "Every guy in cargo shorts questioned their fashion choices after hordes of women ignored them and danced with men in kilts," Milner said. "They were honestly super cool people, loud and happy, polite, kind, and so fun," she said. If the Scots advance from group play in the World Cup, their fans say, so much the better. The team's final stop in this three-match opening stage will be June 24th in Miami against Brazil, a traditional powerhouse. For McCarthy, the longtime Scottish sports writer, one can dream. "It's always been one of life's great ironies that Scotland has never been hugely successful at a sport that is woven into the very fabric of our lives," McCarthy said. "Not for us. The glory of winning the World Cup, as the Brazilians, Italians, and Germans have done so often. Heck, even that lot south of our border, England, have managed to do it." "And if Scotland does not advance," McCarthy said, "every fan who traveled will still have memories to last a lifetime. Hopefully, Bostonians will have the same emotions about the summer invasion of their beautiful city." Poll shows support for Healy, even if voters aren't clear on what she's done, by Samantha J. Gross. More than half of Massachusetts voters said they can't point to a single signature accomplishment Governor Mara Healy has made during her first term. Yet, the Democrat still appears poised to win re-election easily, a new Suffolk University/Boston Globe poll was found. About 56% of the 500 voters surveyed said that if the general election were today, they would vote for, or lean toward, Healy over one of her potential Republican opponents, with the incumbent holding leads of 25 and 27 percentage points over Mike Minogue or Brian Shortsleeve, respectively, according to the poll. The dynamic underscores a race where Healy's greatest achievement is not a lone standout policy initiative or political win, but simply her not being the other guy, said David Palgos, director of Suffolk University Political Research Center. A 25-point lead without a signature achievement, it's not a referendum on her past, it's a verdict on the opponent's future, says Palgos. In other words, he said, being a Democratic incumbent in a deep blue Massachusetts with an unpopular Republican president in the White House means Healy can likely override any policy deficiency. The poll found that voters feel less confident that the state is headed in the right direction than the year Healy was elected governor. Voters also said they would overwhelmingly opt for U.S. Senator Ed Markey or U.S. Representative Seth Moulton for U.S. Senate over the de facto Republican nominee, John Deaton, a cryptocurrency advocate who ran unsuccessfully for a Senate seat 2 years ago. Healy, too, enjoyed major advantages among voters, with some saying that their support is less about specific success, but rather their confidence that she is equipped to handle the job. When asked to name Healy's signature achievement, 17% said nothing, while another 33% said they didn't know, didn't have an answer, or refused to say. A smaller percentage pointed to her posture against President Trump, 5%, or her addressing the state's housing crisis or homelessness, 6%. "I have a few friends that met Mara who say they trust her to make good decisions," said Jeff Hacker, a 67-year-old registered Democrat from Lincoln, "but I don't know what the hell she's done." Gil Squire, a 72-year-old retiree from Stoughton, echoed the sentiment. He said he thinks Healy shows a consistent approach and a lot more statesmanship in dealing with issues than, say, Trump. He also said he couldn't think of an accomplishment that has defined her first term in the corner office. But, he said. She makes me feel sure that she has a serious grasp of the problems. If there is a shortfall in the budget, she finds a way to close it. If there is a problem with the federal government, she states what it is and does not back down. Trump, at times, has dominated Healey's re-election pitch. In an address to last month to activists during the Massachusetts Democratic Party's convention in Worcester, Healey framed the governor's race as a referendum on the president, and herself as the only candidate equipped to stand up to him. In a head-to-head match with Minot, a former Abiomed executive, Healey earned 56% of voter support, compared to 31% of Minogue, a Hamilton Republican, in the new Suffolk Globe poll. Against Shortsleeve, a former MBTA executive, Healey similarly got 56%, while 29% said they would vote or lean towards Shortsleeve of Barnstable. Healey is also beating Minot Munmen, 46-41%, which bodes poorly for Minot, who describes himself as a pro-life Catholic and is vulnerable to losing support from women for that reason, said Pelliegos, the Suffolk pollster. Minot runs a nearly $23 million family foundation with his wife, Renee Minot, that has donated to groups that have touted anti-abortion stances. That includes Prager University, a conservative media organization whose founder, Dennis Prager, has said most abortions are not moral, as well as Massachusetts Family Institute, an anti-abortion pro-family advocacy group. About 51% of people said that the state is heading in the right direction. That's a dip in the Suffolk Globe poll from right before the 2022 election, when 59% felt that way. More than 72% said the latest poll that the country is heading in is in the wrong direction, the highest number in Suffolk polling since at least 2020. In the U.S. Senate race, voters gave Markey and Moulton similar marks in separate head-to-head matchups against Deaton. The survey found 55% of voters would choose Markey, the 79-year-old incumbent, over Deaton if they matched against each other in an election held today. About 54% said they would pick Moulton, a 47-year-old Iraq War veteran who has made Markey's age and seniority a central part of his primary challenge in his own hypothetical matchup against Deaton in November. Most voters also indicated that a candidate's age matters little, if at all, in their decision. About 41% called it a small factor, and 33% said it doesn't matter. That hewed closely to how Democratic primary voters viewed a similar question in the April Suffolk Globe poll, when 36 and 32%, respectively, said that it mattered a little or not at all. In other words, Deaton has an uphill fight against either Democrat, Pelliegos said. Both tests showed that the Democratic nominee is poised to win, he said. The Suffolk Globe poll was conducted over 5 days last week, and its margin of error was plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. Live callers reached respondents via mobile and landline phones.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.
Okay, and we're back. Now to the opinion section of the Boston Globe. Four more wind projects paid $765 million by Trump administration to cancel leases. The Interior Department said Wednesday that it would pay the energy developer Invenergy hundreds of millions of dollars to abandon plans to build wind farms in the Atlantic and Pacific in the third such deal struck by the Trump administration to cancel offshore wind leases. Under the agreement, Invenergy will voluntarily surrender four leases in federal waters for wind farms that would have been located in the New York Bight off the central coast of California and in the Gulf of Maine. All of those projects were in the early stages of development and had little chance of moving forward under the Trump administration, which has halted all federal permitting for offshore wind. Up next, U.S. tells states to deal with unemployment fraud or face penalties. The U.S. Labor Department has told all 50 states on Wednesday that they need to get serious about fighting fraud and waste in unemployment insurance, or else they won't get more money for those programs from the federal government. It's the latest example of President Trump administration's scrutinizing potential theft or misuse in state programs that get funding from Washington. While the letters went to all governors, the public announcement about them focused on issues in three states where Democrats are in charge. That's been the case for many similar announcements from the Republican administration. We are officially putting governors on notice, Acting Labor Secretary Keith Sonderling said in a statement Wednesday. The American people will no longer tolerate the blatant waste, fraud, and abuse of their hard-earned tax dollars. No state should allow it either. If states allow it, they will suffer the consequences. Up next, retail sales, a strong 0.9%, underscoring resilience of U.S. consumer. Shoppers stepped up their spending in May and surpassed expectations as temperatures warmed and gasoline prices leveled off. Retail sales rose 0.9%, up from a revised 0.4% gain in April, according to Commerce Department data released Wednesday. Sales got a boost from generous government tax refunds in both April and May, though economists say that cash cushion is starting to fade. Excluding sales at gas stations, retail sales in May rose 0.7%. The figures aren't inflation adjusted, so higher prices likely helped boost sales. But economists point to healthy spending with increases that were broad-based. Businesses at clothing, accessory, and furniture stores all posted sales gains. Online sales rose 1.5%. There were a few weak spots. Electronics and appliance stores and department stores both registered slight sale declines. The data offers only a snapshot of consumer spending and doesn't include activities like travel and hotel stays. Up next, sleep disorder drugs that target brain circuitry show promise. Alkermes PLC said an experimental drug improved wakefulness and reduced daytime sleepiness in people with a form of narcolepsy, a finding that suggests a promising new class of medicines could help more patients than originally expected. The company's drug, Alixorexton, benefited patients with narcolepsy type 2 in a study. Alkermes said in a presentation at a Baltimore sleep conference on Wednesday, it's among the first trials to demonstrate that a new class of drugs called orexin receptors agonist can work against this type of narcolepsy. Existing treatments largely rely on stimulants or sleep-promoting medicines, which can have limitations and typically don't resolve all symptoms. That's led drug makers to hunt for better therapies that could also address other sleep-wake disorders. And finally, in the entertainment news, the horror disrupting the summer box office. Two of this season's biggest box office hits, Backrooms and Obsession, have a lot in common. Both are horror films with original scripts, made by directors in their 20s who came from the worlds of YouTube and TikTok. And together, they have arguably redefined what a summer blockbuster can be. Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu was the number one movie when it opened the weekend of May 22nd. But the next weekend, it fell behind two much smaller movies, Obsession, directed by 26-year-old Curry Baker, and Backrooms, directed by 20-year-old Kane Parsons, which debuted at the top of the box office. All right, I'm going to read some more news, but I'm going to take a little PSA break. Be right back.
You are listening to Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thanks for listening. We have more programming coming up next.
Up next, this is an editorial in the Boston Globe. Boston needs housing. Massachusetts needs housing. Some projects are stuck. In the midst of a housing crisis and a virtual halt in new construction, a relatively small Jamaica Plain housing complex has become the canary in the coal mine for how serious this state is about growth and about who gets to pull the strings when it comes to new development. The first housing proposal for a 2.8-acre parcel of land, currently the site of the now vacant 90-year-old Poor Clare's Monastery, was filled with city planners more than 3 years ago. This week, the latest iteration of 920 Center Street, as it is known at the Boston Planning Department, comes up for its first public meeting with neighbors. It has 158 total units, more than the 123 units proposed last year. 25% of them, more than the 20% required under city inclusionary zoning rules, will be affordable. But the monastery building, the facade of which had earlier been slated to be preserved, will be demolished. The aim, developer John Holland told the editorial board, is to provide a 50-foot tree buffer around the entire complex. He called it Jamaica Plain's own green monster. And that, he said, was because the site's most influential neighbor, and in the past its most powerful foe, Harvard's Arnold Arboretum and its director, William Ned Friedman, continued to raise concerns. Now they won't be able to see our buildings at all, he added. There's no dispute that the 280-acre Arboretum, owned by the city but operated by Harvard under a 1,000-year lease, is a local treasure, a green oasis in the city and a tree museum for botanists. It also has its own construction needs, plans, and ambitions that require considerable roadwork and additional parking, which all appear to be proceeding apace. Holland and his team and the Franciscan Poor Clares, who still own the property and desperately need the proceeds from its sale to finance the expansion of their new Westwood home, have not been so fortunate. Holland hopes the proposed development's latest version with more units but on a smaller footprint and a larger percentage of affordable units will help turn that around, at least with the neighbors.
Thank you.
Our next story, Massachusetts schools should not take that number one education rating for granted. Other states are catching up because our politicians don't make education a priority. This story is by Will Austin. Will Austin is a former public school teacher, principal, and the founder of Boston Schools Fund. He writes on Substack at Boston Focus. With another school year ending, Massachusetts residents should not ignore or try to explain away with EDU jargon the recent release of the 25 Education Scorecard, a Harvard-Stanford collaboration that aligned decades of national assessment of education progress results with district testing across 8,000 districts with available data. Across America, student learning in reading and math has been in steady decline since 2013. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated this, with America's lower-income students now falling further behind their higher-income peers. This is more than a learning recession or even a depression, and Massachusetts is no exception. The Commonwealth continues to declare itself number one on the NAP and Advancement Placement Test. But the Education Scorecard yields a less celebratory finding. Although Massachusetts maintains the top rank by a slim margin in absolute scores, the Commonwealth has actually ranked only 11th in math and 15th in literacy when academic growth and student improvement are measured. The outcome? Many other states are improving faster than Massachusetts. Maybe Anthony can do something about that. This is not a blip, nor the fault of the pandemic. The data clearly show that Massachusetts student learning started to peak a decade ago and has been in decline ever since. No Massachusetts district made the scorecard's top 100 list of improving school districts. Gateway cities in particular have struggled, with Lynn, Framingham, Everett, and Revere all losing a year proficiency since 2019. But this is an issue for all Massachusetts communities. Even the affluent Massachusetts communities that did maintain learning progress did not keep up with their peers in other states. Take Weston, a town that boasts a median income of $250,000 and SAT scores in the 1300s, still lost ground. What was the response of our elected officials and education leaders? Crickets. And can you blame them? Consider a recent Mass Inc. poll that shows where education stands on Bay State's voters' priority list. There have been many underlying forces that hurt student learning, including the pandemic, lower attendance, increases in mental health needs, and the rise of cell phone and social media usage. There is no shortage of policy ideas and evidence-based practices that could help, both in Massachusetts and nationally.
Fever Fades, Hoist the Sails, by Ayushi Dada. Boston is still in the midst of World Cup fever, but city officials are already preparing for one of the next major summer events. Officials on Wednesday outlined their plans to accommodate the 60 tall ships and 4 million people expected to swarm Boston's waterfront in mid-July for Sail Boston. The celebration will welcome the ships and military vessels from more than 20 countries to the Boston Harbor as part of Sail 250, a multi-city voyage commemorating the 250th anniversary of American independence. The officials said the MBTA will boost subway service and key roads will be temporarily closed along the waterfront to manage crowds and keep things moving during the July 11th through 16th event. Leave your car at home and take the tea, said Deirdre Habershaw, MBTA's Deputy Chief Operating Officer, at a press conference held in Seaport. Six more tall ships are expected than the number that came during the last tall sail Boston event in June 2017. Boston is the tour's last port after the fleet stops in New Orleans, Norfolk, Virginia, Baltimore, and New York City. Organizers expect the visitors to gather along the waterfront throughout the week, but anticipate the highest number on July 11th for the Parade of Sail, the event's centerpiece. During it, dozens of vessels enter Boston Harbor in a coordinated procession. The USS Constitution, the world's oldest commissioned warship still afloat, and the U.S. Coast Guard's Eagle, the training vessel used to train future officers, will lead the fleet. They'll be followed by ships representing countries including Argentina, Colombia, India, Italy, Portugal, and Uruguay, celebrating the country's 250th anniversary by making it a global gathering. Along with increased subway service that day, there will also be shuttle connections linking major lines to waterfront access points, transit officials said. Dedicated shuttle service will be provided from the Red Line's JFK/UMass station to the Castle Island parking lot and from the Orange Line's Sullivan station to the Charleston Navy Yard. On July 11th, all ferries will be suspended to accommodate for the security infrastructure within the harbor, Habershaw said. All ferry routes will operate on normal schedules from July 12th through the 16th. A key infrastructure addition this year is the deployment of the temporary dock extensions at multiple waterfront points, including the courthouse dock area and behind Leader Bank Pavilion. We're putting a large system to extend it to accommodate more tall ships in the harbor, said David Choate, Director of Operations of Sail Boston, adding that the construction of the docks starts next week. Boston Police Superintendent Lenita Colleen said that all laws will be enforced throughout the event, including bans on open containers, public alcohol consumption, marijuana use, drones, and oversized bags in viewing areas. Sail Boston will be on both land and at sea, so security personnel will include city and state officers as well as the Boston Police Department's Harbor Unit. There's going to be some things that we have to do to cater to the different areas where the events are taking place, Colleen said during an interview after the conference. Nick Grove, Chief of Streets for the City of Boston, said that during the event there will be temporary road closures along the waterfront in the North End, South Boston, East Boston, and the Navy Yard in Charleston. He recommended that residents who live near the waterfront review the closures and event days. Public Works and Transportation's team will provide supplemental sanitation services, parking enforcement, and traffic management to help keep our streets clean, safe, and efficient, Grove said. This year, a major digital component will support crowd control. A dedicated mobile application will provide real-time updates on ship locations, boarding schedules, transit conditions, and crowd density indicators. The app went live on Wednesday. If we know, for example, Commonwealth Pier is very crowded, but Charlestown Navy Yard is not, we will put that sort of public-facing information up to direct people where they don't have to wait, Choate said during an interview. Visitors will have the opportunity to tour many of the vessels for free during the week, although boarding procedures and availability will vary by ship. Many of the larger vessels will dock in and around Seaport, including the near Fan Pier and Boston Fish Pier, making the neighborhood the center of activity during the celebration. We are prepared for all of the events that are taking place over the summer, Colleen said, and will continue to operate as we have been. Officials Seek Rent Control Solution by Sam Drysdale. As talk swirls around a possible compromise to the rent control proposal heading toward November's ballot, a top House official said Wednesday that proponents need to get a large group of other folks in the real estate community on board for one to materialize. House Ways and Means Chair Aaron Michelwitz said he has not been necessarily actively going back and forth with anybody, but I do feel like it still has some ways to go if we're going to get a true compromise between the proponents and the entirety of the real estate community. Supporters of the ballot question put forward compromise language a few weeks ago. On Tuesday, NAIOP, one of the most powerful real estate lobbies in the state, said it is now ready to negotiate a form of rent stabilization to prevent the much more restrictive and statewide cap going before votes this November. The timeline to negotiate is shrinking, however. Question supporters must submit a second round of signatures to the Secretary of State's office by July 1st, which serves as a de facto deadline for a legislative solution to keep the question off the ballot. The Secretary's office begins printing voter information guides in July that will have to include the rent control measure or not. I know we had a new addition to the conversation yesterday, and I know that there is new proposals that have been put on the table, Mischwitz said. He continued, I haven't really had any conversations directly about those, but I do know that there is still a large group of other folks in the real estate community that have not weighed in or not necessarily on board with any potential compromise. So I do feel like it is still some ways to go. Also Tuesday, the Massachusetts Association of Community Development Corporations sent a letter to lawmakers signaling support for the compromise, which would allow cities and towns individually to opt in to a common rent control policy. Many of us agree that ballot questions can be too blunt an instrument that to enact nuanced policy, and this is one of the many reasons we are in such strong support of this thoughtful, balanced compromise, the letter said. We respectfully urge the legislature to advance this compromise rent stabilization measure and provide all cities and towns with an optional tool to address housing and affordability challenges. Asked about the looming July 1st deadline, Mischwitz said, I mean, it's getting close, so yeah, it's getting tight in terms of timing. But sometimes these things come together at the end, and sometimes they don't. The Supreme Judicial Court heard a challenge to the Rent Control Initiative petition in May, but has not yet issued its decision. Reporters asked Mischwitz if he was waiting for the SJC opinion. Do they have, the SJC, a challenge on the rent control too? I'm sorry, but I can't keep up with how many there are, he said. I'm not wanting that for myself, and I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but I do know that some folks may think that that is the way to go, but I think I'm not banking on it or anything at this point.
Short one here. Kind of.
Home Kit Tests Ticks for Lyme Disease by Hawathra Bray. Just because you've been bitten by a tick, it doesn't mean that you're going to contract Lyme disease. After all, the tick may not be a carrier. Wouldn't it be good to know before racing to an emergency room? That's why laboratories throughout the United States will test ticks for Lyme disease and other various infections these bugs may carry. You can expect to pay anywhere from $50 to $450 and wait a week or more for results. But you'll soon be able to run a 15-minute tick test in your living room. It's called Lyme Alert, and it's due to go on sale in August, priced at $40 per test. Company founder Erin Dawaki, a pediatric orthopedic physician's assistant, came up with the concept while working toward an MBA from the Sloan School of Management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I went to MIT because I was getting so angry at the U.S. healthcare system, Dawaki said, because it forces me to treat people differently based on their insurance status and that's their socioeconomic status. And frankly, that goes against my ethical framework. She figured that an MIT degree would help her find technological solutions to even out healthcare disparities. I thought I was going to work on healthcare reform at the federal level, Dawaki said. Clearly, the universe had other plans. Instead, she was dragged kicking and screaming into a course on healthcare entrepreneurship. Arriving 2 weeks after the course had begun, she was assigned to come up with a product to improve treatment of Lyme disease, but she wasn't sure how to proceed. Dawaki's breakthrough came to her in the shower. I get my phone calls all the time from my patients, she thought. Hey, I found a tick on me. What do I do? Usually, Dewaki told them to come in and get a dose of anti-Lyme antibiotic, just in case, but while over half the ticks in Massachusetts carry Lyme disease, nearly half do not. An unnecessary doctor visit costs money, and unnecessary doses of antibiotics increase the risk that diseases will become more resistant to the drug.
Well, Anthony, I want to thank you for reading for the first time for us. Everyone, I want to give Anthony a round of applause.
Thank you.
It's really nice having a fresh voice come to Audio Journal and read with us. Well, folks, that wraps up our show for today. And again, I'd like to thank Anthony and thank Bill for his weather update. But it's time to close the show. Boston Globe Live is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Programming is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Mass Commission for the Blind. If you have any suggestions for our program, call us at 508-797-1117 and let us know. We would love to hear from you. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. My name is Harry, reading with Anthony. Have a great rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Hello once again, Audio Journal listeners. This is Bill Ruggiero giving you the latest weather forecast for Thursday, June 18th, 2026. For today, we'll have mostly sunny skies with afternoon showers and thunderstorms likely. Some of the thunderstorms may produce strong gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Highs today near 81 degrees. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely until midnight, otherwise clearing and turning cooler. Lows will be in the mid-50s, except upper 40s in the outer urban suburbs. The outlook for Friday is calm for mostly sunny skies. Highs Friday near 77 degrees. Friday night, mostly clear skies. Lows in the upper 60s. And the outlook for Saturday is calm for mostly sunny skies. Highs Saturday in the lower 80s. Saturday night, mostly clear skies. Lows will be in the mid-60s. And the outlook for Sunday is calm for hazy, warm, and humid with afternoon thunderstorms on Sunday. Highs Sunday in the mid-80s. That, folks, is your latest weather forecast for today, Thursday, June 18th, 2026. And I just want to say happy Father's Day to all of you fathers out there. And this is Bill Ruggiero. We'll catch you again on Monday. Stay tuned for your favorite programs coming up next on Audio Journal. Take care. Have a wonderful day. Bye.
What's your vision? People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team, and we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Building an inclusive workforce where individuals with disabilities are welcome is possible thanks to Mass Commission for the Blind. Partner with them to hire individuals who are blind or visually impaired and reach your workforce goals. The success of your organization depends on the diversity of your team. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or mass.gov/MCB. What's your vision?
You are listening to Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thanks for listening. We have more programming coming up next.